This is a republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the Perry for President, Be Still My Heart edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. Yes, Perry Johnson, you remember him from the governor's race for a few moments last year. He thinks he's ready to be America's quality guru in chief. He's already got another long shot rival, one-time Trump critic turned Trump booster turned Trump opponent now, Nikki Haley. The shit show that's the Michigan Republican Party holds its state convention this weekend, secure in the knowledge their next chairperson will be an election denier.
I'm Mark Brewer. Later in the podcast, we'll talk about what the new Democratic legislature might mean for working men and women in Michigan. Our guest is Michigan State AFL-CIO President Ron Bieber. But Jeff, before we jump into the politics of the day, we have to take sad note of the 67th mass shooting in just the first 46 days of 2023, the heartbreaking attack at Michigan State University. As we record this week's podcast, a memorial service is gathering in the center of East Lansing campus in remembrance of Ariel Anderson, Alexandria Verner, and Brian Frazier, the three victims so far in this terrible shooting. And with prayers for the five more students who are still hospitalized in critical condition at Lansing Sparrow Hospital. So, Jeff, what are your reflections here?
I'm just so sad and sick about this, and not just this because it happened here. It happens again, and it's no different than when it happens in California or Texas or Florida or Sandy Hook, Connecticut. When it happens in the places where we walk and are familiar with, it seems to take on a much more a real gravity than when we just watch distant images on the news. We should recognize the fact that when Sandy Hook happened in 12 years ago, we as a nation missed an opportunity to say enough. And look at the loss of life over the last decade. It could not all have been prevented, but much of it could have been prevented. And I think we need to recognize that. And I'm glad that we have the political will and majorities in Lansing today that are going to tackle this issue with those common sense needed reforms. That who gives a shit what the Republican elected officials will agree to? They don't matter. A wide swath of Republican voters who are gun owners agree with things like red flag laws, background checks, safe storage laws. The list goes on and on. Those are widely popular. 70, 80, 90% of Michiganders support those issues, and it's damn well time that we do it. And I agreed with the Democratic whip in the House and his press release that started off, fuck your thoughts and fuck your prayers. This is exactly the time to be talking about the politics of guns. When this happens, I don't want to sit here next week, next month, next year and have this conversation again and wonder why no action took place and all we did was, you know, this self-gratification thoughts and prayers bullshit that we've been doing for decades now since Columbine. This is all wrong. This is the only place on earth where this happens time and time again to this magnitude. We're not ever going to be able to wipe off all the evil and crazy in the world, but we can do things to mitigate it. And it's damn time we step up and protect the children. I like what Alyssa Slotkin said in a press conference the other day, either you care about kids or you don't. And that really is all this boils down to. It's that simple.
I agree. I mean, this was just, you know, stunning the other night, you know, as I'm watching Twitter and following the thing, brought tears to my eyes. This is a statewide institution, which is just so integral to our state and has been for nearly two centuries, right? And to see this happen, I mean, this event the other night terrorized hundreds of thousands of people, if you think about it, not just the students and everybody else on campus or nearby, but their families and people who knew them and loved them. And so, I mean, it's terror for several hours until it was finally resolved. And sadly, there are students who suffered through this event the other night. This was not the first time that they were involved in a mass shooting. There's apparently an Oxford student who was there and students who've suffered this prior to when they came to MSU. So, yeah, it was just a terrible, terrible tragedy, and we've got to put an end to it. And I agree with you. I mean, I think the governor and the legislature should pass not only the gun control, the gun regulation, whatever you want to call it, measures that they're considering, you know, the background checks, the red flag laws, the safe storage laws, but there are a number of others, which one makes sense, but two, as you point out, who cares what the Republican legislators think about them? They are popular with the voters because the voters understand this madness has got to stop. And I think, again, let's pivot to the politics here now. You know, there are going to be lawsuits when that happens. The NRA is going to be dragging Whitmer and Nessel because she'll be required to defend these laws. We drag them to federal court and ultimately probably the United States Supreme Court saying this violates the Second Amendment. I say bring it on. Bring it on. Bring on that fight. You know, push them. And frankly, again, I think the politics of this, and again, I'm not trying to say we should exploit a tragedy, but I think the politics of this are just wrong for the NRA, for the Republican Party. And this should be a fight that the Democrats, Whitmer, Nessel, and everybody else should welcome because they are on the right side, the popular side, when it comes to dealing with these kinds of things and try to do the best we can to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again. They should not be shy, not be scared of tackling these tough issues because they're doing the right thing and the voters and the people will think they're doing the right thing.
I agree 100%. This is not the time to be timid. And this is the time. Yeah, I have no problem governing with emotion right now. Let's pass laws to do what we can. Let's push the envelope to figure out how we can keep these weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of the people who should never have them.
So, Jeff, but that's turning to more, you know, mundane in comparison political events this week. We did have the Democratic Convention. Last weekend, I was there, 1,600 delegates, a real love fest, people campaigning for U.S. Senate, elected officials all over the place. I was really pleased to see so many of our legislators and members of Congress there. LeVar Barnes reelected as she deserved by acclamation. It was great. I think people are eager. They were eager to be together is what they were and to talk about the agenda for the future. Leadership got elected. There are a couple scuffles, as there always are inside the Democratic Party in terms of some of these district elections, but, you know, nothing unusual. And the party moves on in a very united fashion. But I think that's going to be in stark contrast to what is now just a few days away, starting with an event at the aptly named Nut House on Friday night. What's your take, your latest take on what do you think is going to happen on Saturday?
I've said over numerous episodes of this podcast that I will be shocked if Matt DiPerno does not emerge from this weekend as the chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. And that just shows you how irredeemable and how far down the crazy rabbit hole the Republican Party has gone. They suffered in November one of the a generational drubbing, a DNA altering loss in Lansing, in power in the state. And their lesson that they took away from that was we need to, you know, double, triple, quadruple down on the crazy, the incompetence, and the corruption. People rejected the extremism at the ballot box. They are going to put one of the most extreme, incompetent, corrupt people walking in Michigan involved anywhere near politics in charge of a major political party. And I think that says everything you need to know about where the Republican Party is. There is no turning back. There is no, it will never be 2014 again in the Republican Party. It's only going to get worse and worse and worse, and they're going to continue. They need to lose and lose and lose. Now, we've talked about this before. They can, if apathy, if division on the pro-democracy forces, if people take for granted that they're too extreme to win, we saw what happened in Michigan in 2016 with Donald Trump eking out a less than 11,000 vote victory. We can't assume that that's not going to happen again in 2024 or in the governor's race or the secretary of state or attorney general race in 2026 when those seats are all open. And so they continue to pose a clear and present danger to democracy and the rule of law in Michigan.
Yeah, no, I agree. For our listeners, my reference to the Nut House a moment ago, as some of you may know, there's a popular sports bar across the street from the Lansing Center called the Nut House. And DiPerno is featuring election denier and losing Arizona gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake at a fundraiser there on Friday night. So I think that's particularly appropriate for what's going on. Of course, he's been endorsed by Trump. They had a teletown hall on Monday night, I believe. And others, Mike Lindell, are falling in line. I guess there's still some possibility of Karamo, even though I agree with you, Jeff. I don't see how that happens. And she's, if anything, worse than DiPerno, openly embracing, you know, QAnon and all that other nonsense. But, you know, there is one character who's not in this crazy circus, and that's Barry Johnson, you know, who's apparently, based on his Super Bowl ad and the other stuff we read about him, now has this fantasy of becoming the Republican candidate for president. What's your take on that, Jeff?
I mean, it's not often you get to watch somebody have a, you know, kind of a mental collapse, emotional breakdown in public like Perry Johnson has over the last couple of years. He clearly has far more money than he has sense. And he ran an embarrassing, incompetent campaign, couldn't even get himself onto the ballot for governor. I mean, a perfunctory step, you know, get yourself on the ballot. Squandered $7 million in that effort to not make the ballot. And instead of like slinking away in shame and realizing he's just not up to playing big league politics, the lesson that the so-called quality guru took away from that is, you know, I should be president of the United States. And he's running ads in the Super Bowl, not just in Michigan, where, you know, he might think he could have a shot at the U.S. Senate nomination or, you know, setting himself up for another potential run for governor in 2026. With the kind of money that he has, you couldn't discount his ability to win in the kookiness that is the Republican Party in Michigan. But my God, I mean, to even there's nobody who has an IQ that's measurable that can sit down and draw a path to how Perry Johnson becomes the Republican nominee for president. It doesn't even exist. I mean, it's not even like, well, he has an outside shot. He doesn't have any shot at all. You and I have better shots and we're not running. So, I mean, we're talking about it because of how absurd it is. But because of how much coverage it's gotten, I saw some different reporters tweeting about it. You know, does Perry Johnson have a chance? No, hell no. No chance.
I think I can summarize your views, Jeff. Stick a fork in it, right?
Yeah, I mean, my God, I mean, he can't even think, entertain for a moment that he has a chance. I mean, I don't know what his end game is because I can't imagine that he could be dumb enough to think he has a chance to be president and still be able to breathe and digest food and maintain like a heartbeat all at the same time. I don't get the sense that he's ever going to be governor or statewide elected official, but I didn't get the sense that he's like, I don't know, like a barely sentient being. But if he thinks he can be president, that you have to question whether or not he has any lucidity at all.
With that, we will check in the future, I'm sure, on the ongoing misadventures of the quality guru, Perry Johnson. Thanks, Jeff.
Next up, Michigan AFL-CIO President Ron Bieber joins the conversation on A Republic, If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is pleased to sponsor this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and public policy issues.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, all levels of state and local government, and membership organizations. For the November 2022 election, Epic MRA published the most accurate final pre-election poll among several state and national polling firms.
Our polls most closely predicted the actual election results in races for governor, secretary of state, and attorney general, as well as the three ballot proposals.
Epic MRA is clearly the go-to polling firm in Michigan. visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at The Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
We're delighted this week to be joined by Ron Bieber, who has served as president of the Michigan AFL-CIO for the last 8 years. Bieber joined UAW Local 730 in 1978 after hiring into the General Motors metal fabricating plant in Wyoming, Michigan. He was elected to his first union position at the age of 23 and moved up the ranks, being appointed to the UAW international staff in 1992.
In 2009, Bieber was promoted to administrative assistant to the UAW president and named the director of the UAW's CAP department. In this position, his responsibilities included the administration of the political, retired workers, and civil rights departments of the UAW. Ron also currently serves on the boards of the Economic Alliance of Michigan, the Michigan Association of United Ways, and the Metropolitan Affairs Coalition. Ron, great to have you. We've got a lot to talk about. I mean, everyone in Michigan is affected by the so-called Democratic trifecta. 40 years of pent-up legislative interests, executive actions by a lot of different folks. What's on labor's agenda in the next couple of years?
Well, thanks for having me, Jeff and Mark. It's great to be with you guys. There was so much that happened to labor over 40 years, right? We've got an agenda that goes back 40 years, 40 years of things that we think were bad things that happened to us. But mainly our immediate and first goals are to restore workers' rights in Michigan. The things that were done to us to working people in the state during the Snyder era, when they had total control of state government, that we don't think have a damn thing to do with good public policy, but we're just attacks on the rights of workers. So, you know this, Mark. We don't do anything in the labor movement without having a vote, and we did. My board voted on our top six priorities, and that's the package that that we rolled out as our top priorities of things that we'd like to see happen soon, quickly, and those are all geared around restoring workers' rights in Michigan. I can go through them quick if you want,
Yeah, no. That's what we're here for. Let's hear about it.
So the six things we talked about, obviously the worker suppression law that they passed that has nothing to do with anybody's right to a job or employment. And I hate using the term that they use to describe it, but all labor wants that repealed, obviously. Prevailing wage, we want that restored. Prevailing wage saves taxpayers money by having quality work done and on projects that are bridges, roads, schools, things that we want to have done right with union labor, that with quality union labor, so that it lasts and it's a taxpayer savings in the long run. The retirement tax, actually, the pension tax, I always called it, but now we call it, everybody calls it the retirement tax now. We want that restored. You know how that was done. There was a great feeling that they wanted to cut. They had to raise $1.8 billion to get rid of the Michigan business tax. And the way they did it to raise it was to start ticking off things that they could do to working people, and the retirement tax and the earned income tax credit was one of the things they did. And they just kept doing things to raise a dollar amount till they got to $1.8 billion. And that was one of them. And we thought it was wrong and that it should come back. The earned income tax credit obviously is in there too. There were some things that were done that have nothing to do with good public policy, but were just power moves to take power away from workers and their unions that represent them. One was the payroll deduction of union dues. makes absolutely no sense for any reason other than to take power away from one side and give it to the other. I could, if I was a worker in a plant today, I can deduct out of my our payroll deduction to give to the company's PAC, but I can't do it to give to the union's PAC. And it makes no sense other than to try and hurt workers. That was, just, in my mind, just an egregious thing to do. The same with payroll deduction of union dues for school employees and public employees. Again, there's no cost to it. We bargained the cost of that in our contracts with our employers. There's no cost to it. Once it's set up, it just rolls, right? It's just an electronic thing that happens every time the payroll is run. But those two things, and then we made a bucket that is kind of a catch-all that is restoring collective bargaining rights. And that's, you know, nobody got gutted worse, attacked worse, and needlessly than school employees and public sector workers. And the things they did, to, you know, that was just an attack on public schools and teachers. And, you know, they gutted the things that they can bargain for. And there's no reason for it, again, other than some desire to attack public education. So those are our first bucket of priorities, are restoring these workers' rights.
Well, I don't think there's any mystery to some of those things that you said there and some of the motives. And I guess I can, you know, by way of confession, attest to how correct you are, because I was in the room when a lot of those things were happening. you know, there's certainly, it was, you know, most of the moves over the last 30 years that I've been part of this were, you know, designed for political power. I mean, you know, that's, you know, elections have consequences. I recognize the consequences of some of my actions, and I've been doing a lot of mea culpa over the last few years, trying to focus on the bigger pictures of democracy, pulling us back from the brink. And so, you know, looking at the success that the pro-democracy forces had in 2022 and with the Democratic majorities now in Lansing, this is the natural outcome of that, is that many of those things are going to be reversed or changed and altered. And that's just the ebb and flow of politics. And so, you know, it's I think that the most of Michigan's political class and business structure is preparing for this and understanding that this is just the inevitable consequences of elections.
Yeah, I think that's right. And honestly, it's a shame it has to be this way. It didn't used to be this way. There were certain lines years ago, either side, the political sides, there were certain lines neither side would cross. You think John Engler didn't want to get rid of right to work? Of course he did. But then they did a lot of things, similar things, but didn't cross that line. And the same on the other side. It wasn't about the pure and utter destruction of the other side. You know, you had real debates around policy, and that's gone. And it's a terrible shame. And that, in my mind, it's all because of all the money that's flooded into the game, and you know, which, until we can fix that, I don't know how we fix some of the rest of it. But
yeah, you're right. I mean, I was sitting in Randy Richardville's office during that time back in 2012, I think it was, while all of that was going on, and you know, you're exactly right. There was a lot of people, including Randy, who weren't very, didn't have much of an appetite for it, but the rest of his caucus did. And well, politics being what they are, and at the time, I mean, when you look at how far and how much our politics have changed in the decade since then, even, you know, that was maybe one of the tipping points that have taken us over this last decade to a point where we're no longer opponents, but enemies in our politics. And that's it might sound like a nuance different, but we talk about that nearly every week, how it has changed. And it really is a threat. Now, I mean, I look at my former political party on the Republican side, and I don't consider them just opponents any longer. Many of them are existential enemies to our politics, our culture, and our rule of law.
Yeah. And it's a damn shame, Jeff. It's not good for anybody. When democracy is this fragile, we are in deep shit in my mind. We should be having debates around issues, debates around policy, but not this way crazy, destroy each other mentality. If we can't fix that, this country's in big, big trouble. It's the same thing with that thing I hate talking about that has nothing to do with anybody's right to have a job or employment. You know, that is all about workplace democracy. No union just comes in and plants itself someday and says, we're here now. We're running the show here. It's a democratic vote in a workplace to establish a union to be the representative in the first place. And it's a majority vote. That's the way this country's supposed to run. So, I mean, unless I still pin it all back to all the money that flows through this and the Citizens United and all the things that happened that allowed money to take total and absolute control. We gotta fix that somehow.
Well, I think, Ron, appropriate of your point, if you look at the list of items you mentioned, there are several items on there that benefit all working people, not just union members. And I think one of the things that, our listeners and others need to remember is that the labor movement has never just been an advocate for people who are members. It's been all working people. I mean, you mentioned the earned income tax credit, right? That benefit a lot of folks. There may not be many union members who even qualify for that. Same thing on the retirement and pension tax. Sure, there are union retirees who were stung by that, but there are a lot of non-union folks who were stung by it as well. And I know, one of the topics, projects I've been working on, you all have been very supportive of our effort to raise the minimum wage here in Michigan, even though none of your members are making the minimum wage, and to get earned paid sick time for every worker in Michigan. So I thought it was important. I want to inject that here in terms of, kind of the broader agenda, because too often in these back and forth, like Jeff said, enemy making fights that we have now, labor gets pigeonholed. It's like, well, you're selfish. You only care about, the union members, but that's not the case. You can appoint a lot of items over the years where the labor movement has gone to bat for all working people, not just its members.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I feel every day like I'm working for all workers, all the people in Michigan, whether they're represented or not. I'll give you the perfect example. And one is that EITC. That has stuck in my craw from the day they did it. If you had to raise that money to give give businesses that $1.8 billion cut, why go to the most vulnerable working people in this state? That in my mind, that was just wrong. Go somewhere else and try and do that, not on the most vulnerable. And I got to say this, Brian Kelly, the hypocrisy of him now pretending like he invented that we should, he's a savior of the working poor and the most vulnerable working people by advocating almost sounding like he invented the EITC. He was the one who proudly cast the tie-breaking vote as lieutenant governor in the Senate to gut that in 2011 when they did it. I hate to call people out by name, but the hypocrisy just calls for it. That's the part that gets me. The part of, it's class warfare at that point. And like you said, we fight for minimum wage to increase it. We don't have many members, if any, who are making below minimum wage, but we want to bring up all wages of all workers and make life better for all the citizens.
Yeah, ironically, on the earned income tax credit, as I recall, that was a Reagan-supported idea back in the 80s. So it once had, and I hope still has, some bipartisan support. But you're right, we've really descended into this tit-for-tat, vengeful kind of politics, which is really, really unfortunate. I want to talk about another topic, if I could, though, Ron. The AFL-CIO, you were very active in the redistricting process last year, the new process we have with the commission. You submitted plans, you testified. And so I just want to get your take on, one, that process. And again, I think this is an example of organized labor, participating in a process that benefits far more than just its members. But focusing on that process, why did you decide to get involved, and what are your thoughts, in retrospect now, with the new districts?
I think that was a game changer. And frankly, that happened in 18 on the ballot. We didn't really do that. I think people think always that it was organized labor. That wasn't. That was a citizen-driven, led project that we really didn't have much to do with. Our union members are citizens too, but that originally passing that, that sent shockwaves. And in my mind, that's part of the reason why today there's such anxiety, because everybody who knows anything knows that system was rigged for decades and those lines were drawn the wrong way. In any event, we got engaged because we want fairness. We want to see balance and fairness. And with, you know, there should be fair and balanced democratic elections. And that's what we wanted. And our members just felt they pushed us, frankly. To tell you the honest truth, it's not what I wanted to work on that year. I really wanted to work, and I do every cycle, on municipal elections and really get back to working on getting at the grassroots level, getting our members elected to local office. But it was, you know, that was there. It had to be dealt with. And our members pushed me, frankly, to get our members out there speaking up, because they were a community of interest too. Workers are a community of interest, just like everybody else. And, you know, I think the maps came, there were some spots where I thought they could have been a little bit different, a line drawn here or there, a little bit different. But all in all, they came one hell of a lot fairer than they had been in the past rigged system. So
I think Brother Timmer can give you an amen on the past gerrymandering.
I would say that I don't disagree with anything you're saying, but I would say that let's at least acknowledge that the fellow who drew those maps the last 30 years was quite witty and handsome.
And he still is. And he's with us today. But we've heard, and Jeff, I'm not trying to flagellate you here. We've heard your mea culpas before. I'm not trying to, berate you.
No. I mean, well, you were, I guess, what you were saying there, Ron, about, you know, Brian Kelly's vote back in 2011. I guess a decade or, you know, 12 years can make a whole hell of a lot of difference. When I look at what I was doing in 2011, 2012, I was drawing those gerrymandered maps and helping, you know, pass right to work. That's what I was doing, and in 2023, I'm in a whole different place. And so I guess I've learned in my fight against Trumpism, extremism, and protecting democracy, that I'll take converts along the way, regardless of people's past. If they're willing, you know, a true conversion, if they're willing to be allies now, I'll take their support.
I don't disagree with that. I'm not sure it's a true convert. Because in his mind, I think, and I've heard this, that if they think that if they give those working poor that little bit of tax relief, that they're going to come back to work, because they think people are sitting at home because not working because they're not getting an extra $1,000 or whatever. That part bothers me, because anybody who's in that position economically is not sitting home over $1,000 or $1,500 a year. They can't afford to. And that part is the part that the hypocrisy of that bothers me. This whole people after the COVID business, great resignation or whatever they call it, that's nothing more than workers waking up and saying, people saying they're walking away from jobs, right? They're not walking back to jobs that they had. Well, they're saying they're not going to work at bad jobs anymore for bad pay and be treated badly while doing it. That's what that's about, most of it. And then the hypocrisy of thinking that somebody who's at the far, far bottom end of the economic system is staying home, sitting on a couch because they're not getting an extra $1,000 from a earned income tax credit is not right. Now, we should incentivize those people, not to get them to work harder, but to give them their families a fair chance at a better life. I don't know if you guys know what ALICE is. It's called Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed, ALICE. It's not a woman, it's an acronym. I'm on the board of the Michigan Association of United Ways. Every year they put out this ALICE report. So they the quick of it is they study how much it costs just to for a family just to survive, just to be able to pay for the basics in every county in the state. And then they look at incomes. Do you know that 40% of the work, this is people who are working, not people who aren't working. 40% of the working people, working families in this state do not make enough just to survive. And that's the criteria they use is just the basics, housing, food. I mean, that opened my eyes. When I got on that board and saw those statistics, I'd never heard of it before. And man, oh man, that was an eye opener for me. That's why the earned income tax credit and that hit so deeply with me. I mean, that just seems so wrong. And why I get up in the morning to try and drive workers' wages up. So workers in this state got a fair chance at a decent life. This is a great state and there's plenty of opportunity. It boggles my mind why we can't make it better for working families.
Ron, a little bit ago, you mentioned and you laid a lot of the problems that we have with basically the campaign finance system. You know, all the money that's flooded into the system in the course of all three of our careers. I mean, the system has changed dramatically in the course of our careers. So, you know, where is the AFL-CIO on that? What kind of reforms to, you know, funding of politicians, funding of elections would you all like to see?
It's most of it's for sure transparency. There's got to be some transparency of who's putting money in where, right? And if that itself happens, it would stop some of it because the people are some of the big money I'm talking about. I'm not talking about me writing a $50 check to a state rep's campaign, but the big money that doesn't get disclosed, there's no place for that in my mind. The Citizens United stuff, you can't have unlimited money just flowing around everywhere. You guys know as well as I do the influence that money has with the decision makers. And you know, in my mind, a lot of it is transparency. If people had to disclose, they won't do it. I hate to bring it, but I watched the Michigan head of the Americans for Prosperity on Off the Record last Friday, and they asked her about her donors and who was funding it. And it was no, we don't disclose. We don't. Well, until that changes, things are just going to keep going the same way.
Well, I think we've got, and Jeff and I have talked about this over the course of our podcast. Now, just the latest examples of that are all the scandals revolving around Shirky and Chatfield, and now maybe even Wentworth, let alone Rick Johnson. That's not directly campaign money, even though some of it is, but these C4s, right, that don't have to disclose their donors and can shuffle money around and hide its origin and so forth. Yeah. I mean, the corruption is here.
It all gets to the same place, buying influence, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it's until we have the transparency that stupid stuff can't happen, we're going to be stuck in a system that's just broken and doesn't work.
So if somebody, you know, I'm not trying to pin you down too specifically, but it's just in general, if there were to be reforms like to the lobbying laws or to the campaign finance laws in the legislature, the AFL would generally be supportive of moving in the direction of transparency. Sounds like what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, most any reform we would be for it. This system does not work. It works if you're mega rich or powerful. For the average citizen out there writing a $10 check, it's not working.
No, I don't disagree. I mean, we've almost developed a theme here with the podcast. I think this is 3 weeks in a row we've ended up talking about campaign finance reform and transparency. A couple of weeks ago, we had some national experts. Last week, we had the chair of the Elections Committee on talking about reforms, the Elections Committee in the House. And now here we end up talking about it again. And I think that's one of those issues that's it cuts across partisan lines. When you get aside from the Republican elected officials or party officials, Republican voters by and large would agree with this. This is one of those 70 or 80% popular issues among Michigan voters. They say, yeah, we should know who's paying for what, who's getting what, where it's going, how it's being spent, and who it's coming from. That makes sense. I mean, I said on the show a couple of weeks ago that, you know, I could even make the case that I don't care if somebody gives $1 million to X candidate, but I want to know about that. And with our technology today, we should know about it like tomorrow, not 3 months from now or after the election.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. That's why I say if there was transparency of itself, it would make a difference. And then, you know, you could look at limits and whatever is a, another question. Do people think people should only be able to give so much? Whatever? That's a different question. But the transparency piece, that should not be that you can give $1 billion and not have to disclose that.
You know, Ron, before you talked about the Redistricting Commission, how that was, you know, not initiated by labor or by the Democratic Party. I mean, it truly was a citizens initiative. But, you know, there's been a couple of other citizen proposals, you know, the pro-democracy with the small D reforms that were passed in 2018 and then last year. Where was the AFL on all of those? I mean, are those the kind of things that you think, again, it's going to make it easier to vote for all working people? Were you supportive of those proposals?
Yeah, 100%. And again, we didn't start them. We didn't. It wasn't us that did it. This was a citizen-driven initiatives. But we're for any kind of democracy issues and making everybody should have the right to vote. It should be easy to vote. And, you know, the more participation, the better we are off as a country, as a state, as a society. I wish everybody voted, frankly. And I think we should make it as simple and easy as possible. That cheating stuff, that is not happening. I mean, show me the facts and then I'll listen, but it's not happening. So we ought to be making it as easy as possible. I represent working people. Before we had no reason absentee, it is damn hard after you work in a factory or wherever you work all day. We've got nurses and people like that that work 12-hour shifts. And, you know, before, unless you lied, you couldn't get an absentee ballot, basically. And that's wrong. And we should, that change itself made it so people have a lot easier access to the poll. But it's hard after you get out of work. And then everybody gets out of work to go stand in a line for 2 or 3 hours. And people have childcare issues and everything else that just make it difficult. What really bothered me, that those were a stroke of luck and we were 100% behind them. I'm not a stroke of luck, but a stroke of good effort to make those changes. What really bothered me was the people who tried to throw up roadblocks and roadblocks and roadblocks to make it harder. Again, that's just trying to rig the system, and that's wrong.
Yeah, let people have their vote. Let people have their vote. Well, you know, a couple of the other things now with the trifecta, the governor's got an easier time now making appointments, right, because the Senate won't obstruct her there. Also, executive actions. I assume in addition to legislation, the AFL-CIO is interested in the quality of judges in the state, you know, the quality of appointments to university boards and so forth. So, you know, do you all keep an eye on those kinds of activities as well?
Yeah, we watch when the appointments come up or judicial appointments and things. We watch them. And sometimes, honestly, labor's not all together on what somebody will have a favorite over here and a favorite over here. And sometimes we weigh in, sometimes we don't. Yeah, but it's a part of the process and it's a part we play in. We watch it and it, you know how it goes. When one side's in, they get everything. And when the other side's in, they get all the appointments pretty much. It's important. That's important business. And again, on a university board, that shouldn't be hard. You know, you don't want hardcore on either side, political people on there. You want people that are going to go on there and run a university correctly, you know, and look out for the faculty and look out for the students and the best interest of education. So it's something we definitely watch and participate in. Maybe not as much as everybody thinks, but it's something we do.
Well, Ron, you know, before we let you go and wrap this up, just wondering, are there any other projects that the Michigan AFL-CIO is working on? Or, you know, for our listeners, is there a way to follow the activities of the AFL-CIO? You have a website, or can people follow you on Twitter? I mean, how can people keep track of what the AFL-CIO is up to?
We've got all that. One of the biggest things has been the resurgence of our, we call it You would know it as HRDI. It's been around forever. Well, it's a C3 where we do worker training, and frankly, we were cut out. It functions off of state grants and federal grants and things, but we were cut out politically. We were cut out of the process. But now we're receiving. We're back in business, and we are going into underserved communities. And you know, there's a big talent shortage in this state in the trades and things, and it's critical. And that's been one of the biggest things we've been focused on. That's kind of non-political, but important to the welfare of the state to repopulate the workforce, and also help those in underserved communities, give them a hand up and a leg up to get gainful employment. There are great career opportunities in the trades, but WDI has a website. The Michigan AFL-CIO has a website. We've got Twitter accounts. You can find us. We're out there.
All right. Well, Ron Beaver, president of the Michigan State AFL-CIO, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to give us an update on what the AFL-CIO is up to and what its priorities are. We really appreciate it, Ron.
Yeah, thank you, guys. It was fun.
And that's a wrap for this week. Our thanks to Ron Beaver for sharing his views on the future of the labor movement here in Michigan, the birthplace of the United Auto Workers.
Next week, we'll take up the usually popular issue of tax cuts with the sponsor of legislation raising Michigan's working families tax credit, Senator Kristen McDonald Rivett. If the Republic is still standing, Mark and I return in a week. Thank you for listening.
MSU, we love thy shadows when twilight's silence falls, flushing deep and softly paling o'er ivy covered halls, or beneath the pines we'll gather to give our faith so true, sing our love for alma mater and thy praises, MSU. When from these scenes we wander and twilight shadows fade, our memory still will linger where light and shadows play. In the evening oft we'll gather and pledge our faith anew, sing our love for alma mater and thy praises, and